Kane directed the beam of his Nighthawk microlight around. As he half expected, the amber glow revealed cunningly concealed hiding places all over the barn. He marched toward the black inner recesses of the structure.
Kane, there may be more of them back there.
I sure as hell hope so, Baptiste.
There wasn't much to see except piles of garbage, empty food cans, and heaps of straw. In an enclosed stall, he found a horse, a big sorrel obviously used as a dray animal. It wore a rope halter around its head, and it was on edge from the smells and sounds of blaster fire, as well as the scent of fresh blood. When Kane approached, it laid back its ears, rolled its eyes, and back-kicked the wall.
Kane?
It's all right. I found a horse.
What kind?
A scared, mean one.
In a partitioned alcove that served as a tack room, he saw a leather harness hanging from hooks on the wall, and where there was a harness, there had to be a wag. A rear door opened onto the outside. The cold air hit his face with a slap that was very cleansing after the close, stinking atmosphere of the barn. He found a two-wheeled box cart, its rails propped up against the wall. The wheels were old rubber tires with worn treads. Kane walked back inside the barn. Grant and Bridget were herding the surviving Scupsies together, huddling shoulder to shoulder.
Grant, help me hitch the horse to a wag. Baptiste can cover the dickless wonders.
I don't know anything about horses or wags or hitches. Bridget is our resident expert on everything. Let her help you.
If we leave you alone with these jolt brains, you might be tempted to chill them all if one of them looks at you cross-eyed.
So?
So the whole countryside could be crawling with them. For all we know, cutting off their tools and dressing up like gaudy sluts is the fashion rage among Russian men nowadays. I don't want us to be targets of a blood hunt. We need to focus on what's ahead of us, not behind.
Let's do it.
At the stall, Grant warily eyed the horse and slowly swung the gate open. The horse backed up.
Keep it covered. If it tries to bite or kick me...
I'm not going to chill a horse on your account. Show it who's boss. Pretend it's Domi.
Kiss my ass.
Grant reached for the halter nervously.
Shit! You tried to bite me, goddamn nasty son of a bitch!
You would be too if you had to live with these slime slags.
Kane waited until Grant had secured a grip on the horse's halter before hauling the harness down from the wall. Luckily for Grant, there wasn't enough room in the stall for the animal to rear up.
God damn it, horse, hold still!
You won't get him to cooperate that way. Talk nice and slow to him. Treat him like a baby.
You mean like I treat you? Come on, horse. I'm not gonna hurt you. You're probably just mad because those guys tried to put a wig on you too, huh? That's it. Let's go outside.
Once outside, they harnessed the animal to the two-wheeled cart. Kane had anticipated a time-consuming and frustrating process of trial and error trying to figure out the intricacies of the harness. Fortunately, with only a couple of mismoves, they managed to hitch the horse to the wag in less than 10 minutes. Kane stepped to the door of the barn.
Baptiste, time to move.
I told them to stay put until we're gone or else we'd kill them all.
Think they bought it?
I don't know. They all started pouting. Want me to repeat it?
Fuck 'em. They've been warned. Let's go.
Grant was already in the driver's seat of the cart, experimentally tugging and testing the reins. Bridget climbed into the back. Kane lingered at the open door of the barn. She saw him make an underhanded tossing motion. He turned and approached the wags.
Keep a tight hold of those reins.
Why? Whoa! God damn it! Whoa!
That's why.
Kane climbed up and sat next to Bridget. Hungry flames roared through the barn, illuminating its dark, dank interior with the brilliance of an exploding star. All of them felt the jolt of searing heat. Long threads of light gleamed between the planks of the exterior wall. Bridget gave Kane an accusatory stare.
What? They'll have plenty of time to get out. With any luck, the fire will spread to the rest of the ville, smoke out this rat's nest once and for all. It's worth the sacrifice of an incend. Let us be off.
Cold-blooded, but stylish.
Something you're born with, you know. You either have it, or you don't.
Bridget looked away from Kane, shaking her head in exasperated weariness. A footpath led to a wide, two-lane ribbon of blacktop. A river ran alongside it on the left, swirling around half-submerged boulders. On the right side of the potholed road, the forest was heavy and dark, massive pine trees growing so close together that the boughs were intertwined. The conflagration of the barn smeared the night sky with a wavering glow that could be seen for miles, the light peeping through the branches of the tall pines.
It'll burn itself out soon.
If it doesn't fire the whole ville in the woods, it may draw attention we don't need.
You worry too much, Baptiste.
One of us better, don't you think?
After a mile or two, Grant learned how to control the horse with tugs on the reins and clicking noises with his tongue. Within a half hour, the winding blacktop angled away from the river, climbed up a hill, then dropped down. Fog swirled and eddied in front of them as the wag rolled down the promontory, descending into a shallow valley. Ahead, mist hung heavily above masses of shrubbery and brush that grew in tangled madness on both sides of the road. The horse splashed through puddles of stagnant water, covered with a scum of sickly-looking green. By the glow of her microlight, Bridget checked her rad counter.
Getting a low-end yellow reading. The closer we come to Moscow, the higher the rad count.
Though there was no obvious sign of bomb damage, all of them knew that the Americans had employed a significant number of neutron weapons during the nuke cost. Damage from explosive warheads was minimal, though the spread of lethal radiation had been vast. Kane checked his wrist chron. Even though it was still set on Montana time, he quickly performed the calculations.
Getting on to 5 o'clock. Sun ought to rise soon.
Grant, in the driver's box, glanced to his left and his right. Even his dark vision glasses couldn't penetrate the mist. Ghost-like shadows of dead trees thrust their gaunt skeletons above the undergrowth. The chill wind had died completely, but he still felt cold. The air was dank and clammy. The horse reacted to the oppressive atmosphere by laying its ears back and shying from every shadow. As the path inched and climbed its way out of the valley, the horse seemed to grow more apprehensive. It shortened its stride, taking slow, cautious steps, ignoring Grant's jerks on the reins.
What are you doing?
I'm not doing anything. It's this contrary pile of soap bones.
Despite Grant's prompting, the horse stubbornly kept decreasing its speed and length of stride. Finally, it came to a complete halt, ears cocked forward, standing stiff-legged and alert.
Yeah!
Grant slapped the reins against the animal's rump, but except for a nervous quiver, it still refused to move. Kane looked past the horse, into the thinning mist, feeling the back of his neck tingling. He slid out of the cart, the sin-eater filling his hand.
Something's ahead.
Bridget climbed down onto the road, Mauser in her fist. She moved around to the left side of the wag, standing slightly behind the wheel. From around a bend in the path, a halo of dim light appeared from the fog. A figure appeared, walking casually, a rifle slung over a shoulder. He held a lantern high in his right hand, and its light glinted from a silver disc pinned to the ear flap of his fur cap. He didn't see the horse and wag until he was nearly 10 feet away. When he did, he hastily unslung the rifle from his shoulder. Even in the feeble light, Kane and Grant recognized the blaster as an old Soviet AKM, an improved version of the even older AK-47. The man was young and slender, barely out of his teens, with the silky beginnings of a mustache on his acne-spotted face. He was bundled up in a dun-colored greatcoat.
Stay where you are.
The man had trouble holding the rifle and the lantern at the same time, but he was clearly loath to relinquish either.
Don't shoot. We mean no harm.
Who are you?
Kane framed him in the sights of his sin-eater, but Bridget stepped around the wag. The Mauser dangled by her leg, concealed by the folds of her coat.
Visitors. Is this the way you treat strangers you meet on the road? Point guns at them?
The man lowered his rifle and lifted the lantern so the pale beam washed Bridget's face. He didn't appear too reassured by the sight of a strange woman. Or perhaps it was the two men in black wearing sunglasses on this dark night that unnerved him.
I asked, who are you?
And I told you, visitors. Who are you?
Private Petaya from the Internal Security Network, Ramenki Bureau. What are you doing on this road?
Bridget tried one of her smiles on him. Ramenki was one of the inner suburbs of Greater Moscow, so they were on the right route.
We are traveling to Moscow.
From where?
From back there.
There's nothing back there but Berodolinko, and it is a forbidden zone.
Forbidden to whom, Private?
To all, except for members of the network.
Precisely.
You are agents?
Yes, a special investigative unit.
Investigating Berodolinko?
Yes, it is deserted.
Petaya lowered the barrel of his rifle.
That's good. That's very good. Captain Ivornich has been asking Central for months to dispatch investigators. I was afraid you were one of them.
Them?
Skopsis. They've been known to waylay travelers, sometimes sneak this way into Moscow for victims. I patrol this road once a week, looking for signs of them. I'm very glad to hear they are finally gone.
They are, Private. Now we must be on our way.
I'll go with you so you can report to the captain.
Not necessary.
My shift is nearly done. By the time we reach my station, it'll be time for me to go home. There will be hot coffee for us, too.
He turned and started up the road at a sprightly pace. When he was out of hearing range, Bridget told Grant and Kane of the conversation. Grant couldn't help but chuckle.
Investigators, huh? He's not that far off the mark.
Yeah!
The horse responded to the reins again, and they set off after the young man, following his lantern like a beacon bobbing in the mist.
What happens if we're questioned by the kid's superior? If their setup is anything like the Mag Division's, he'll want to see our orders.
It's too risky not to stop by. Hopefully, they'll be bogged down by just enough Vill-type bureaucracy to give us the chance to brazen our way through.
The condition of the road improved the longer they rolled along it, though they saw wide, barren swaths, forevermore poisoned by radiation, turned into perpetual dust fields. They topped a rise just as dawn broke up the dark sky with pink and orange brushstrokes, and Ramenki lay before them. The community seemed little more than several rows of old two- and three-story houses divided by a river that flowed beneath a rickety-covered bridge. Most of the houses and buildings seemed structurally sound, but in dire need of cosmetic attention. Pitted walls, peeling paint, and ugly black patches shone through the cornices. The streets were deserted, and there were no lights. All the windows were shuttered. Garbage littered the gutters and alley mouths, its odors strange but still foul. Small, darting creatures foraged in the rubbish. After a bend in the road, they saw a pale blue light glowing over the arched entrance to a low, stone-walled building. A sign suspended from cast-iron moorings was imprinted with a single word in Cyrillic, Militsiya.
It says police.
Pattaya made for the steps leading up to an iron-bound wooden door, waving at them to disembark. Grant reined in the horse at the curb.
I'll stay here.
Good. I'll leave my transcom channel open so you can listen in on whatever there is to hear.
Don't talk to anyone. Pretend you're a mute if you have to. And Kane, let me do all the talking no matter what happens.
Of course.
They headed up the steps.
I mean it, Kane. You'll have to follow my lead if things turn nasty. Act taciturn. That shouldn't be too much of a stretch.
The interior of the police station was as barren as the exterior. It consisted of a cramped, stuffy common room that held a pair of battered metal desks and several chairs. Bulky, old-fashioned black telephone units were on the desktops. Sheets of coarse pulp paper were everywhere. Tacked to the walls, scattered on the desks, wadded up on the scuffed, unvarnished floor. An old cast-iron stove glowed red in a corner. Atop it was a coffee pot, and the heady aroma set up a longing in Kane's taste buds. Beside the stove was a door, standing slightly ajar. Beyond it, barred cell doors could be seen. Captain Ivornich stood up from behind a small desk when they entered. Not even the dull maroon uniform blouse, high boots, jodhpurs, and wide black gun belt that girdled her slim waist could conceal the svelte figure beneath. Kane's breath caught momentarily in his throat. Despite her lack of cosmetics, she was very lovely. The woman's black hair, pulled back severely from a remarkably high forehead, fell down her back as straight as a frozen flow of India ink. Her oval face was of marble whiteness, and her deep violet eyes were slightly tip-tilted, hinting at Asian ancestry. She was a bit shorter than Baptiste, but very slender and muscularly athletic in build. She was perhaps as much as 5 years older, but her complexion was smooth and unlined. Her eyes, rich with suspicion, flicked back and forth between Kane and Bridget, finally settling on him. Kane immediately sensed an electric tension spring up between the two women.
I have heard nothing of a special investigative unit for Peredelenko dispatched from Central. Let me see your credentials.
We are part of a covert operations team. We were not issued credentials as a standard security measure. You should know that.
What is your name and rank?
Irrelevant. We need not establish our identities to you. It is enough for you to know that both of us hold ranks higher than your own.
Indeed. Then why did you stop here?
A simple courtesy, to apprise you that Peredelenko should no longer be of concern to you. All the Skopsis are gone.
To where?
Does it matter, Captain? They are out of your jurisdiction. That should make you happy.
It does, if true. With only myself Pattaya and one other officer, our resources were strained trying to keep tabs on them. Thus, I am very happy to hear your report. So will your superior, no doubt. To whose authority do you report?
Bridget's mind raced, though her slightly scornful, slightly superior expression remained intact. Ivornich's question was very reasonable under the circumstances, and trying to evade it would arouse her suspicions further.
Sverdlovsk.
Pyotr? I mean the colonel?
Bridget only nodded. A bit of the tension ebbed, but it didn't vanish completely.
Why didn't he tell me? I've been after him for months to send agents from Central down here to clean out Peredelinko. Why would he not let me know in advance so we could coordinate our movements?
As you know, his duties require his absence from Central for long periods. He approved the investigation before his latest trip.
You know about that?
About what?
The project.
Of course.
Of course. And of course, Colonel Sverdlovsk has yet to return from his latest trip. Therefore, I cannot contact him to verify your story.
You call me a liar?
Not at all. But if you are who you say you are, then you understand the security protocols and proper channels. Moscow Central agents traveling the countryside without identification is not particularly unusual, I grant you. Not riding in an official network vehicle can be easily explained. But you and your silent comrade pique my curiosity. You speak with an accent I cannot place, and that piques it even more. You claim your rank exceeds mine, yet you are considerably younger than myself, and I know I rose very quickly in the hierarchy of the network, despite my posting here.
Though King didn't understand a word she said, his point man's sixth sense, a subtle prescience of impending danger, caused his hand to instinctively ready itself to receive the Sin-Eater. Ivornich deftly spun the receiver to her ear.
Da?
She listened intently, then dropped the receiver back into its cradle.
My curiosity must remain unsatisfied for the time being, but only for a short while. The colonel is returning to Moscow this morning. You may meet him personally and make your report at the railhead in Ilyamanov Station. You do know the area?
Of course.
The image of the numbers on the crates in Mongolia appeared startlingly clear in her mind.
Tell me.
12.
Exactly.
Bridget turned confidently toward the door.
Then we shall be there.
Kane also turned to leave.
One moment, sir.
Though Kane didn't know what she had said, something in her tone conveyed that she had addressed him. He cast her an over-the-shoulder glance, eyes masked by his dark glasses.
Unlike your colleague, you have the look of a professional, of one of us. I should know you, especially if you outrank me. Why don't I?
Your security classification is not high enough, Captain, to know this man or even to speak to him.
We shall see. Until then, keep this in mind. The worst kind of death is reserved for agent provocateurs. They rarely die easily or quickly.
Bridget and Kane walked out of the office. Grant, still seated on the wag, sagged with visible relief when they came down the steps.
My, she is a bitch, isn't she?
Da.
She didn't even offer us coffee.
No, but she did seem awfully interested in you.
A purely professional interest, I'm sure.
What was all that gibberish about?
Let's get rolling and I'll tell you.
Get rolling to where?
The railhead.
I don't know where that is.
We had better behave like we do. I'm sure the good captain will put a tail on us to make sure we get there.
Yeah. Well, horse, so far, our first few hours in Mother Russia are turning out to be a whole lot of no fun.
Lakesh walked into the historical division. He passed archivists going off shift, and they greeted him with respectful, deferential nods. The only person who didn't nod was a black-coated mag who had stepped into the elevator with him at the promenade. In fact, he went to a great deal of effort to pretend he hadn't noticed Lakesh. The mag had remained behind in the elevator, and Lakesh knew he was whispering into his hotel transcom, reporting to Salvo that he was here, reappearing unannounced after a two-day absence. Lakesh repressed a smile. The mag, and others like him, were victims of forces too powerful and too insidious for them to combat or understand. The man wasn't an enemy. The forces that had made him a magistrate were the enemies. He walked through the long, broad corridors of the division, past scores of sealed doorways that led into hundreds of chambers and antechambers. All of them were filled with the relics of vanished cities and long-dead people. The quiet air smelled of dust and time. Time past, time present, time future, and time twisted out of shape. Most of the storerooms were crammed to the ceiling with racks upon racks and shelves upon shelves of a vast number of books, magazines, and technical manuals, articles of clothing, crates of paintings, pieces of statuary and sculpture. Anything that had survived the new cost more or less intact. Lakesh pretended that he took pride in the fact that the Cobaltville archives contained a greater volume of pre-dark artifacts than any other vill in the network. He entered the main work area, the chemically treated rainbow insignia on his bodysuit allowing him to pass through the invisible photoelectric field without activating alarms. A long row of computer stations, half enclosed by partitions, all faced a long blank wall. Hidden behind the stone and steel reinforced wall was a bank of sophisticated mainframe computers, the heart and brains of the division's database. Around him, the archivists hurried to their machines. There were 50 direct digital control computer stations in the huge room, with 60 operators always on duty. The 10 extra archivists were kept as a reserve force in the event that someone became too incapacitated, or in Brigid Baptiste's case, too arrested to handle his or her keyboard. The monitor screens lit up. Long rows of silent men and women became automatons who served as the revisionists and editors of human history. Lakesh scanned the faces of the archivists and wondered how many of them wished they would drop down dead. It was impossible to tell from their facial expressions, somber and preoccupied, with perhaps a touch of cold intellectual resolve. Their whole lives, from conception to death, were ordered for them, both at work and at home. As long as they obeyed the maddening and contradictory volume of rules, they had security, as well as medical and even retirement benefits. Lakesh stood and watched the workers for a few minutes. As senior archivist, it was his duty to pretend interest. The spy eye vid camera on the ceiling transmitted his image down to the magistrate's intel section. When he felt he had put on a sufficient show, he shuffled into his private office. It was fairly spacious, but it didn't have a window, not that he gave a damn. Past generations had labored in buildings such as this, in office suites, in corporate headquarters, their life energy sucked away until nothing was left but flesh and bones. The war to leech away the human spirit had begun a very long time before January 20th, 2001. Lakesh had never worked in a tower or a skyscraper, never had a corner office with a view. He had spent nearly 30 years of his life in an underground installation beneath Archuleta Mesa, just outside of Dulce, New Mexico. During that time, he had labored day and night, never feeling as if it were actually day or night, on Project Cerberus, a major subdivision of the totality concept. Sitting down behind his desk, he turned on his personal computer. Like all the machines in the division, it was equipped with a direct digital feed to the mainframe database. Unlike all the other machines, it had no built-in governing hardware or security lockout programs to restrict his access and thus alert a monitoring official. He tapped in his clearance code and opened an untitled file. The symbols and numerical sequences appearing on the screen would mean nothing to an observer who didn't hold an advanced degree in quantum physics. Lakesh had received such a degree in his late teens from MIT back in 1970. His education had been furthered in Dulce, handling technology that should not have functioned, yet did so beyond even a theoretician's wildest fantasies. In his years at Dulce, first as a tech head, then as overseer of Cerberus, he had learned, or rather begun the process of unlearning, that quantum scientific principles were not a form of new physics at all, but a rediscovery of ancient knowledge. As a physicist, he always sought symmetry, but rarely in nature were symmetries perfect. They were often slightly broken, almost imperceptibly flawed. It was a manifestation of a broken symmetry that now obsessed him. During those last few years, he read the growing body of scientific theory that megalithic structures such as the dolmens of Newgrange in Ireland and Stonehenge in England were expressions of an old, long-forgotten system of physics. The theory, based on hyperdimensional mathematics, provided a fundamental connection between the four forces of nature. In the relativistic universe of Einstein, energy flows downhill, hot to cold, from higher to lower energy. A spinning celestial body, such as a planet, would have a connection to uphill and downhill energy flows from an invisible higher dimension to a lower one, in which humans lived and perceived their reality. Evidence indicated there were many vortex points, centers of intense energy located in the same proximity on each of the planets of the solar system, and these points correlated to vortex centers on Earth. Lakish was sure some ancient peoples were aware of this and manipulated these energies to open portals into other realms of existence. He suspected the knowledge was suppressed over the centuries, an act of repression he believed was the responsibility of the Archon Directorate or the secret societies in their employ. It was an axiom of conspiracies that someone or something else always pulled the strings of willing or ignorant puppets. He had expended many years tracing those filaments back through convoluted and manufactured histories to the puppet masters themselves. Perhaps, he thought, studying the mathematical formulas on the screen, by employing hyperdimensional physics, the Archons go back and forth from our world to their own. And if his hypothesis bore fruit, those naturally occurring gateways could be closed off, or used as peepholes to spy on the Archons as they had spied on humanity for eons. Or even used as doorways into the past, where the seeds of humanity's enslavement had first been planted. Though Lakish rarely strayed beyond the borders of science, even theoretical, he had made a study of ancient history, scanning very old texts for clues to Archon involvement in human evolution. He didn't have to look very deeply before he realized that the so-called alien UFO phenomenon dated back before the 20th century when it gripped public consciousness. In fact, the historical records of non-human influence on Earth ran uninterrupted from the very dawn of mankind to the present day. Always it was the same, human beings as possessions, with a never-ending conflict bred between them, promoting spiritual decay and perpetuating conditions of unremitting physical hardship. And always secret societies were created by human pawns to conceal and to protect the true nature of humanity and its custodians, or masters. Loathing once more rose up within him. No matter how deep the roots of their influence extended, the Archons didn't belong on Earth. They hadn't evolved here. They were from outside, and they needed something from humanity. Perhaps as desperately as a leech needed blood. He still didn't know what. Even after all his years of research and study, his work was pitifully incomplete and inadequate. With the loathing came guilt. He had helped the Archon Directorate to cull, to contain and control the masses of humanity, and now he wanted freedom from his guilt and freedom for mankind. Humans, despite all their failings, had at least learned the concept of acknowledging that others of their kind had the right to freedom. True, they forgot easily, and had to be reminded often, sometimes violently, but the history of respect for each other was there. The Archons, wherever they came from, had no such history. Perhaps they knew nothing whatsoever of respecting the rights of other life forms, inferior in their eyes, which they viewed basically as property. However, he had come across cryptic references to other non-human entities that appeared to be, at least superficially, more benign than the Archons, and these entities were always connected in some fashion to the ancient megalithic structures in Europe. He recalled the millennia-old legends of the Tuatha De Danann wafting into Ireland on a city of light with many treasures and superior weapons. They had built four great cities that were the centers of science and learning. The sites of these cities were allegedly entrances to the Bru, magic places not inhabited by humans. The Bru na Boin, Newgrange by the River Boyne, was the most important of these places. Lakish felt a jolt of fear and he fought it down. Physically, he was nearly 100 years old, chronologically a shade under 250, and he refused to be frightened by anyone or anything. This was a sound he hadn't heard in 3 months. It was a summons to Alpha Level, to a meeting of the Trust, the latest incarnation of secret societies acting as insulation between the Archon Directorate and what was left of humanity. Lakesh saved his calculations and engaged his comp's encryption lock, though it was an unnecessary precaution. Not even Salvo would dare to audit his computer work, nor could he understand it if he did. Lakesh's image as the venerable senior archivist, the devoted servitor to the Baron, was important. Therefore, he always walked as if he were only a few steps from expiring completely. He actually could maintain a sprightly gait if he cared to. Several of his joints were prosthetics. He was on his second set of lungs, and his old leaky heart had been repaired by surgery and was equipped with a pacemaker. Bionic replacements for worn-out joints and new organs were one of the benefits of sleeping in cryonic stasis for a century. To be of use to the unification program, he had needed to be as fit as cybernetic alterations could make him. Once out of the workroom, he entered a short corridor leading to a storage area. The passage dead-ended at a locked door that supposedly led to a room filled with old printed matter. Lakesh inserted a key into the lock. Inside the door was an elevator shaft just large enough to accommodate two men. He stepped onto the pancake-shaped elevator disc and pulled the door shut behind him. Automatic lock solenoids snapped into place, and the disc on which he stood shot upward. Every level of the admin monolith possessed a private hidden elevator, known only to members of the Trust. He strode down the ramp and into the Baron's suite, the Puppet Master's alcove. All the strings of power in the Ville extended down from this level. The foyer was magnificent, as was every room in the suite. Glittering light cast from many crystal chandeliers flooded every corner of the entrance hall. At the far end of the foyer, flanking huge ivory and gold inlaid double doors, were two members of the elite baronial guard. Their impeccably tailored uniforms consisted of polished black boots, short white jackets, and red trousers. The guards opened the doors.
The Lord Baron awaits you in his private lounge, sir.
Lakesh saw nothing but a deep, almost primal dark. The Baron's level was the only one in the monolith without windows. Lakesh walked forward, heading toward the dim golden glow of a single light shining over an open door. When he saw the light, he realized the Baron had not called a meeting of the Trust. Baron Cobalt sat alone in a room so completely soundproofed that the ears grew weary of trying to catch a whisper of outside noise. No one ever came to the Baron's private audience chamber unbidden. In fact, only Lakesh's special status as one of the original architects of both the Totality Concept and the Unification Program allowed him to be alone with the hybrid ruler of Cobaltville, the eyes and hands of the Archon Directorate. Baron Cobalt wasn't unprotected, however. He sat inside the curve of a small horseshoe-shaped desk. Rows of buttons and toggle switches lay within easy reach of his delicate fingers. If Baron Cobalt pressed one button, his guard promptly appeared. If he pushed another button, his personal staff came. Very few people outside of certain members of the Trust knew what the Baron looked like. It was part of a tapestry of mystique, of deception, and of deliberate misinformation. Baron Cobalt's excessively slender body was draped in a one-piece dark golden robe that accentuated the pale gold color of his skin. It was stretched tightly over a narrow, hairless skull so elongated that it resembled an upside-down teardrop. Very small ears were set low on the sides of his head. His face seemed to consist primarily of delicate brow arches, prominent cheekbones, and a very long, very sharp chin. The large eyes were slanted, and the big irises were a beautiful yellowish-brown in color. He wasn't tall, and in fact looked very fragile. If his muscles had little strength in them, then the power of his will and his station more than compensated for his physical shortcomings. What he willed to be always came to pass.
My good friend, my trusted friend.
My Lord Baron, how may I be of service to you?
You may help me to understand the nature of a problem. It has vexed me far longer than it should have, yet I cannot come to a resolution or wipe it from my mind.
What is the problem?
The Baron's long, artistic fingers suddenly clenched, hooking like an eagle's talons. His mouth writhed, contorted, as if he were trying to repress a scream or a sob.
Cain. Cain.
The Baron's beautiful eyes blinked, brimming with sudden tears. Lakesh kept a tight rein on his shock, not allowing it to register on his face or demeanor. He looked at the tears with great interest. It never occurred to him that members of the hybrid dynasty could weep.
He laughed at me! He humiliated me! He assaulted me! He laughed at me! I can still feel the brute's paw around my throat, holding me helpless. I tried to reason with him. I told him that the ideal solution to a better world lay in the creation of a better human, and that I represented the better human. I explained that once the superior life form was in power, then the final depopulation of the old type of human could be realistically, profitably, and painlessly carried out. He didn't care. Do you know what he said to me, the filthy apeling? I shall never forget it. He said, "You're not a god, King. You're not divine. You're not even a good employer. You're a laboratory monstrosity with an attitude. A vampire living off the genetic material of human beings. You have to take baths in chemicals and gore. You're disgusting is what you are."
Lakesh knew Cain had violently confronted Baron Cobalt in Dulsa, but he had never heard the details. He was a bit shaken by the intensity of emotion, and he now understood why the Baron had isolated himself for the past few months. He had been as humiliated as a demigod could possibly be by a lower life form, who not only refused to worship him, but even sneered at his claim to divinity.
"I told him that much of my superior genetic human material derived from his father, and that made us related after a fashion. He didn't even care about that, Lakesh. Why? Tell me why."
"Who can say, Lord Baron? He is human."
Baron Cobalt cleared the tears from his face with angry swipes of his hands.
"But I am human too, and I don't understand what he wants. Why he said what he said, or why he did what he did. I meant him no harm."
"You said it yourself, my lord. He is the old type of human, and you are the new. He simply could not understand."
"How could he not understand that we, the oligarchy of barons, represent the most singular achievement of biological pioneering in the history of this planet?"
"Very few old-type humans can grasp the staggering implications of the project, my lord. They cannot stretch their ordinary minds to encompass its detail."
"Yet you understand."
"I am a scientist. I have lived most of my life in a scientific environment. Long ago I realized the inherent limitations of man, and therefore accepted this most ennobling of human goals, the creation of the superior human."
"Yes. The drive to improve the strain of humanity began long before I was born, long before the Holocaust. Hitler's Aryan breeding farms, for example. Of course, selective mating to produce the human of the future's better world required too much time. A new thinking that led to the same end at a much swifter pace was plainly demanded. Hybridization was an absolute necessity after the new cost. I can see that. You can see that. Why cannot others see it?"
"Perhaps they cannot see what you and I see because they are obsessed with freedom."
An ideological term. They should be concerned with other things than primitive concepts of physical liberty. Besides, none of them would know how to use freedom if they had it, would they?"
"Indeed."
"Cain must believe he is free, do you not think so?"
"He is running, hiding, my lord. That is not freedom."
"Perhaps not to you or I. But to an apeling like him, escaping my justice must be the most liberating experience of his wasted life. He must answer for the destruction he wreaked in Dulsa. The project's timetable was unforgivably altered, you know."
"Surely the responsibility of finding Cain and his confederates lies with the Magistrate Division."
Baron Cobalt steepled his long fingers beneath the point of his chin.
"True. Ansalvo has yet to produce results. I want those results."
"I sympathize, my lord. I too was betrayed by one of my own archivists. However, dwelling upon it would prevent me from devoting my full attention to my work."
"Cain is my work! and from this moment on, he will be your work as well. He will be the work of all of the divisions, of all of the Vils.
Lakesh tried to keep his face from mirroring his astonishment. To witness Baron Kobold losing his serenely detached control and screaming like an enraged, frustrated human child was shockingly unexpected.
I will not allow it, do you hear? For the past three generations, humans have been taught a gospel of weakness, and they must not learn how to understand and hate and fight again. Cain could teach them how. The human race must not be allowed to rebel and turn against the doctrines.
Lord Baron, Cain is not a revolutionary, nor a visionary. He is simply a criminal, an outlander. He does not deserve your personal attention.
I know what he deserves, and I know that he will receive it. If I do nothing else, I will make certain of that. And you will help me.
Grant and Cain had visited some old pre-dark vills where attempts at rebuilding had begun, but none of those places had received the full devastating fury of nuclear weapons like Moscow. Entire city blocks were completely barren and empty of movement. The day dawned bleak and gray, but the wind didn't rise appreciably, and the temperature, though low, was bearable. The cart rolled along the paved, litter-choked streets, between bombed-out ruins and tumbled-down apartment buildings. Some areas were nothing but acre upon acre of scorched and shattered concrete, with rusting rods of reinforcing iron protruding from the ground like withered stalks of some mutated crop. On the horizon, a clump of high towers topped by spires and minarets was outlined against the sky. Bridget used the map to fix their position in relation to the rail yard. Despite her eidetic memory, it wasn't easy, since so many of the landmarks noted on the map were missing.
Cross over that two-lane highway.
It was early yet, so there wasn't a dangerous amount of traffic, but all of them were surprised by the number of gas-powered vehicles on the road. In America, in the Vills, such transportation was reserved for the elite. When they looked closer, they saw that many of the wags that rumbled up and down the blacktop bore the silver circle insignia designating them as official internal security network vehicles. On the other side of the highway, a big sign spanned the width of a broad avenue.
Nicolino Street Marketplace. Good. We're only a few blocks away from Ilyamanov Station.
Cain eyed a truck idling at the mouth of an alleyway.
We should just ditch the horse and buggy and grab some real transport.
We're supposed to be security agents, not thieves.
In that case, we'll requisition what we need in the name of the state.
The signs of habitation, if not civilization, became thicker. One entire lot was covered by tents. Some of the tents were elaborately embroidered. One was colored so luridly it obviously contained everything an undiscriminating shopper could want. Liquor, food, gambling, women, and the dubious privacy of canvas-walled boudoirs. The smells were strong and pungent, even biting. It seemed as if every other door had a sign above it advertising that vodka in some form could be purchased or bartered. Bridget couldn't help but wonder if only alcohol made life tolerable in nuke-blasted Moscow. There were wags, mostly oxen-drawn, and a few buggies, but most of the people they saw walked in a trudging, downcast gait. The reason was the parade of sect network men and women, wearing drab overcoats and toting old Kalashnikov auto rifles. The sec agents gave them and their wag hard, piercing stares as they rolled by, but said nothing. Still, their attention made Cain nervous. He didn't think much of Bridget's provisional plan to pretend they were network operatives themselves.
They'll be tailing us right to the rail station. We need to get ourselves lost.
If that's where Sverdlovsk will be, that's where we need to be. He helped me get out of Mongolia alive.
And he might help all of us get dead here in Russia.
He's the only lead we have.
We're foreigners, hated Americans. We're here to spy, remember? That's not exactly a well-respected pastime in any country.
My feeling, my instinct, is that whatever Sverdlovsk and maybe even Ivornich are up to in the Gobi, it has very little to do with the good of the state.
All right, Baptiste. You speak the lingo. You met the bastard. Your call, for now.
Vendors opened up food stalls, and the primary items seemed to be vegetables, particularly potatoes. A few merchants sold small household items, and the prices posted on everything made no sense to any of them, even Bridget. Overall, the Nicolino Street Marketplace reminded Kane and Grand of the Tartarus pits. Both of them became slightly wistful with nostalgia. The wag came abreast of a lot enclosed by a split-rail corral. Inside the crude fence milled livestock, sheep, goats, pigs, a few cows, and a couple of horses. The air was redolent with the rich aroma of manure. A beefy man wearing a leather apron and a wool cap, pulled down low over his head, gestured to them.
Stop. Here's where we can ditch this rig and get a little spending capital.
Oh.
Bridget hopped out and approached the burly man. He walked around the horse, studying its withers, the hooves, peeling back its upper lip to inspect the animal's teeth. Grant noticed the man had no ears beneath his stocking cap, only hacked-off nubbins with bits of fleshy lobe attached. Kane saw one of the overcoated sec men standing across the lane, watching and listening to the exchange with great interest. He sidled up to Bridget.
We've got no time for this. Whatever he offers, take it.
Bridget shot him a steely glare, but ducked her head and held out a hand. The beefy man immediately produced a roll of paper currency from an apron pocket and counted out 10 notes. They were printed on a fibrous wood pulp and absurdly colored, featuring a badly out-of-register engraving of a stern, fatherly man with a white beard. Grant climbed off the cart, gave the horse a farewell pat, and the three of them walked away. Bridget riffled through the bills.
He would have paid more, you know.
You're as bad as a pit jolt merchant. No matter what he paid, it was still a clear profit.
If I'd accepted his first offer, he would have become suspicious.
But three officers of the Internal Security Network haggling over the price of horse flesh is perfectly acceptable. We were being watched, you know. If it's reported to Ivornich that we stopped to sell livestock...
We'll deal with that when or if we have to. Let's find the railway station.
The avenues opened up, became broader. People were beginning to file into the market district, and they seemed to be of every shape, size, and color, sporting every kind of garb. Grant, Kane, and Bridget mingled with them, deliberately seeking crowds.
Pretty diverse bunch.
Russians were only one of over 100 nationalities in the old Soviet Union.
The building styles were as diverse as the population. Old buildings dating back to well before Skydark, newer ones that were throwbacks to earlier styles, duroplast domes, and great squatting stone masses with no discernible architectural design. They tramped the thronging streets, past shops, past brothels, gambling halls, and saloons. There were many eating places, all spilling exotic odors into the street. Although they were hungry, they decided against sampling any of the food.
We don't want to risk contracting Uncle Vanya's revenge.
They crossed the Boulevard Yagovard and passed into the squalid side lanes that fringed the marketplace. People slunk in and out of alleys, prowling for Jack, a bottle, a pinch of narcotics. No one molested them. Kane glanced over his shoulder.
If we had shadows, I think we lost them in this place.
Their route led them beneath an elevated railroad trestle. A cumbersome-looking steam locomotive chugged overhead. On the other side of the trestle, they saw a confusing network of railroad tracks crisscrossing around huge dark warehouse sidings. They picked their way over the rails and the greasy gravel toward the main terminus. As they approached, the sun slowly broke through the gunmetal gray cloud cover and touched what little color remained on the peeling yellow paint of the railroad station. Peering through the sooty windows of the waiting room, they saw varnished benches, a scuffed linoleum floor, and twin chalkboards for arrivals and departures. An old woman, white hair bound in a scarf, drowsed behind the ticket window grill. They looked up, then down the tracks, seeing nothing but oily wooden cross ties, rusty rails, cinders, and a lot of soot. They saw no trains or people. There was only a man dressed in a uniform of heavy black twill pushing a broom on the opposite side of the platform. Bridget left the others and walked over to the sweeping man. She asked him a question the others couldn't hear. The man hooked a thumb over his shoulder. Bridget rejoined Kane and Grant.
What was that about?
I asked him where to find track 12.
And?
That-a-way, in the old factory complex.
With Bridget in the lead, they left the platform and walked between two sets of tracks toward a rail yard adjacent to the station proper. They wended their way through a maze of shunts, past empty flat cars and rusted machinery, toward a collection of dirty warehouses. They heard the train before they saw it approaching. The three of them hunkered down behind an embankment and watched. It was the same old steam engine they had seen crossing the trestle at the outskirts of the marketplace. It was several tracks away, reducing its speed as it slowly moved toward a large, dark building that stood isolated beside a double railway spur. Around and behind it were other big buildings, probably part of an old industrial park. The train came to a stop alongside the building. Two men climbed down from the cab, and even at a distance of 100 yards, they could see they were wearing the overcoats and disc-decorated fur caps that identified them as SEC network officers.
See that?
What?
The number on the building right above the door. It's the number 12.
Where'd you get this reputation for poor eyesight?
I'm astigmatic and farsighted. I can see things far away perfectly.
The SEC officers didn't walk a post, but simply took up guard positions on opposite sides of the door. Kane studied the facade of the building. A row of windows ran some 6 feet up all around the dingy walls. He looked again at the guards. One of them lit a cigarette, the other stifled a yawn. They decided to risk approaching the warehouse. They walked in a crouch at the bottom of the embankment until they reached a point where a small, tin-walled storage shack blocked them from the view of the SEC officers. Patiently, they worked their way toward the warehouse, keeping to cover as much as possible, stopping frequently to watch and listen. Almost 30 minutes passed before they stood in the shadow of the building's west wall. Grant, the tallest of them, tried to open a window. It was unlatched, and he slid up the wooden sash. He investigated the frame with his fingertips, searching for alarm wires. Then he slowly chinned himself upward, took a quick look, and lowered himself to the ground.
There can't be anything important in there. Only two guards, windows not locked.
You may be right. There's only one way to find out, though.
Making a stirrup with his hands, Kane heaved Grant up to the opening. The fit was tight, and he struggled, wriggled, and kicked his legs to work his shoulders, then his hips through the frame. Under any other circumstances, the sight would have made Kane laugh. Bridget followed next, lifted up by Kane and helped inside by Grant. Gripping the edge of the windowsill, Kane pulled himself up, his boots finding traction on the rough-textured wall. Lowering himself to the gritty floor, Kane looked around. The light, peeping in through the grime-streaked windows, was sufficient for their dark-vision glasses, though Bridget took out her Nighthawk microlight. The interior of the warehouse was high and cavernous. A length of railroad track ran into it from the outside, beneath a closed pair of wide, cross-braced doors. Big wooden crates were piled to the ceiling, some of them unmarked, but others stenciled with the Cyrillic numeral 12. All of them silently and carefully surveyed their surroundings. On a long trestle table rested a high stack of 6-inch-thick, paper-wrapped slabs, 4 feet wide, 10 feet long, and perfectly rectangular in shape. Kane, Bridget, and Grant soft-footed their way over the dusty concrete floor to the table, walking around it, examining the slabs. Kane tore a corner piece of the paper away. Beneath it gleamed a glassy substance, somewhat translucent and a pale ochre in color.
Armaglass. A lot of it.
I didn't know Russians manufactured this stuff.
I didn't know anybody could manufacture it anymore. The stuff still in use in the Vils was left over from before Skydark. It's not good for much, is it?
Shielding. One of its properties is that it goes opaque when exposed to certain levels and wavelengths of radiation. That's one of the reasons it's used in the Mattrans gateways, to block energy overspills.
Then it would be useful in Karokoto, since Lakash said the place was very hot.
We don't know if Sverdlovsk has anything to do with Armaglass.
He's supposed to show up at Warehouse 12 in the rail station. So this has something to do with him, all right, even if the Armaglass is not bound for Mongolia.
What do you want us to do? Hang out here and hope Sverdlovsk arrives? And if he does, you'll pop out and say, hey, remember me?
What do you suggest?
Durek. Grant and me will split up, check out the zone. You can stay here, just in case your pal does show up.
Agreed.
Find a dark corner to wait in. Monitor us on your transcom.
Before they left, Grant and Kane ate a protein bar apiece from Bridget's survival pack, washing it down with long drafts of purified water. Climbing through the window a second time was no easier or dignified than the first. They went to the rear of the warehouse, made certain their transcom frequencies were open and in sync, then walked off in opposite directions. Kane kept his sin-eater leathered as he trod a path through high weeds and scattered machine parts. Most of the rusted hunks of metal were so corroded as to be unidentifiable. He walked behind a row of warehouses, sensing that most of them were long ago abandoned. He saw and heard very little. Kane crossed an overgrown strip of gravel alley between a pair of warehouses. He saw an open-topped Jeep, painted a dull ochre, tearing up a muddy road ribbon beside one of the tracks. Immediately, he sensed triple red danger. He was exposed, and he knew the two uniformed sect men in the vehicle had spotted him. The Jeep skidded to a halt at the mouth of the alley, and the men climbed out, looking toward him suspiciously. They carried Kalashnikov rifles in shoulder slings. Kane was about 20 yards away from them, hidden from the waist down by weeds. He continued to casually cross the alley, as if he had every right to be doing so. Running would only catch the eyes of the officers immediately. He reached the other side of the alley and veered to the left, toward the compound of an old factory. Judging by the mounds of slag, the great litter of steel scrap, it had been a smelting plant at one time. He spoke into his lapel transceiver.
Triple Red, I think I've been made. Stand by. Observe radio silence until you hear from me.
A big building stood behind the slag heaps. It had no door and was probably an easy place to become lost in. Kane continued to walk at a steady pace. He didn't turn his head, but the sin-eater slid smoothly into his palm.
Ostanovka! Opradyelitye!
Kane kept walking. Suddenly, he dived to his left. Kane rolled behind a pile of iron posts and came up running in erratic zigzag pattern. Kane ran faster. The building loomed massively before him. He stopped running, pivoting on his right heel, leading with his blaster. One round smashed into an officer's shoulder and twirled him around in a bright spray of crimson. His companion threw himself to the ground. Kane turned and dashed behind a mound of slag, then raced for the open building. Kane guessed correctly that the injured man was calling for reinforcements. Once they arrived, they would fan out and cover the area, but that would take time. Kane sprinted into the building. He loped through the murky emptiness until he reached the far side, eyes darting back and forth, seeking an exit. He leaned against the corrugated metal wall and listened. He heard nothing on the other side of it. Sliding along the wall, he found a loose section of tin and yanked it carefully away from the wood crossbrace. He managed to ease his body through the small opening and found himself in a wilderness of grotesque iron shapes. He moved through them swiftly, doubling back toward the warehouse where Bridget was waiting. Armed, uniformed men marched all over the perimeter. He had no idea where they had come from. When he reached a position where he had a fairly unobstructed view of the rail yard, he saw a large covered truck parked near one of the warehouses. A silver circle was painted on the cab door. He considered hailing Grant to warn him, but discarded the notion. He might be in hiding, and even the whisper of sound made by the transceiver circuit engaging could give him away. Kane gazed for a moment at the truck, wondering if he and his companions had indeed tripped an alarm somewhere inside the warehouse and called up the hounds. If so, Baptiste was in grave danger, trapped inside of the place. He began moving again, sometimes in a crouch, often crawling on his belly through the high weeds. The men searching for him were nearby, but they were not yet too close. Finally, he reached the rear of the warehouse, crept beside the west wall until he reached the window. It was still open, and he heaved himself up and through it, feet first this time. He dropped lightly to the floor on the balls of his feet.
Grant, do you copy?
Kane started to speak into the transceiver when he heard the step behind him.